Welcome to Life Lab, hosted by David Ponder and Zach Schaefer, where we inspire listeners to live the good life through organic conversations about evergreen topics.
Life Lab captures our belief in personal evolution and a growth mindset. So,
experiment with life.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It feels good to be back. We've taken a little bit of a hiatus.
Forced hiatus. Yeah. Travel and summer.
As it has been the summer, and now here we are, it's Labor Day weekend, and we're getting back at it. And I got to say, it feels good.
It does.
Right? And when I think about the reasons, or think about the summer and how this summer has gone, I tell myself a story of the way things have gone, how I've landed to where I am today, and it helps me make sense of all the different things that have happened this summer. You know, if I had to count all the things that have happened in my life that had some sort of meaning to them, it would be in the thousands of things that have happened just this summer. And so I got to boil it down somehow. I got to have it make sense to myself. So I tell myself a story of how this summer has been, and it makes sense. It makes me feel better.
I like it.
Yeah.
So what is the story of your summer then?
Well, it's funny because people ask you, how was your summer? You know, and then you start off very broad. Oh, it was good. It was a good summer. And then you start to narrow it down and pepper in some things, right? And it's interesting how you feed them the details of what it is that you want them to know about your life, right? So for me now, kids are a big part of my life. I generally focus on kids, talk about big events like travel, stuff like that, right? Usually surface level stuff, especially if you're just making nice conversation. But yeah, like I think about audience. You think about audience when you answer that. And it's like, who are you talking to? What details are you going to give?
Right.
Like if you walked into a counselor's office, psychiatrist's office, you'd probably dive into some deep stuff, you know, just start unloading.
You'd tell a story.
Yeah. Well, you're always telling a story, right?
Well, all the questions that we get at, hey, how's it going? Those are asking for stories, but we've just, the norms of politeness and social interaction have shortened down to one word answers. Fine, good,
yeah,
busy.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's funny because by default we wonder, how much story do they want?
Well, when we look at people that actually give long answers for those social politeness norm questions as weirdos.
Yeah, there's social cues. There's like a social back and forth where you give a very high level answer and you say, I'm doing fine. I'm doing well.
Right.
You know? And you might throw in one more detail just to see, do you really want to talk or are you just being polite?
Yeah. Yeah. So what are we talking about today?
We're talking about narrative.
Narrative.
Stories.
See, those are the same thing. They're the same thing. But I think the way that when people throw out the N-word narrative, I think they're trying to sound smart.
That's good. I like it.
All the people that we follow, they're always, oh, the narrative being. It's just story, folks. It's the same thing. But when you want to sound smart and strategic. I'm going to hit the main point I wanted to make. I think people, when they're talking narrative, are trying to sound strategic and intelligent. But I also think that narrative in an academic setting is a bigger term, a meta term. It's a meta story. So from an academic standpoint, the narrative is the background structure and systems from which all stories must be told.
Mm.
Right. And so when we hear that online or in daily life and people say, oh, the narrative, they're literally just meaning what's the story. But in an academic setting, all stories told on a daily basis are part of a larger ongoing meta narrative that's unfolding that you can't really change as easily. So I like to think of narrative as more of a strategic story that somebody can tell, and stories are more tactical. The day-to-day things.
I like that.
Think of it like a battle.
I like that.
There's a meta-narrative you're going to tell the troops for how the whole thing unfolds, but then each battalion's going to have different stories to motivate them to get get things going and get done what you need done.
So it's like an epic that is built of short stories. And the epic is the narrative.
Correct.
And the yep. short stories are the stories.
Yes. But the way people use the word narrative, especially in the online community, is to sound smart, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that makes total sense to me. Just thinking through this, because we threw it out as a topic, because we started talking about what are the stories that we're hearing in society today, you know, and why? What do you think they're getting at? And we started picking that apart. And I thought that was interesting how we did start picking that apart and trying to understand where I think when we were – even when we were younger, right? And so I'm not – I don't think that this is just a part of intelligence. I think it's part of experience. When we were younger, those the stories that got told, we would talk about those stories, and then we would say what we thought about those stories. And we, you know, everybody has opinions on the stories that are being told, but I'm not sure that we would have picked them apart in the way that we do now, where we're literally trying to deconstruct what it is that they are, what the messages are in the story, and what the motivations could be behind those messages. And
yeah.
I think that that's an evolution that we've made that I think probably comes with age and experience and wisdom.
Well, and there's quite a bit of cynicism in that as well.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what are you really getting at? What's the hidden agenda?
Mm-hmm.
You don't think of that as kids.
Yeah.
But people are complex and there's multiple motivations. Story, though, narrative or story, call it either way, it's simple. It is, but we make it so complex. Every story is – a good story begs one question. Do you know what that question is? If it's not a good story, you're not thinking this. If it's not a good book, if it's not a good conversation, if it's not a good movie or a good show, you're not thinking this. What happens next? That's it. If that's not in your – ooh. That's why all movies and shows, they try to add, or even if it's the last one in a series, they leave something open so that it leaves that, ooh, well, what could happen next? It has to be there. We need – humans need that anticipation of what's to come.
I like that, and I'll take it from that – from the way that you just introduced it as powerful and entertainment to, yes, that's absolutely true in everything that is told, and it's also powerful for persuasion.
I was just going to say persuasion is absolutely. Persuasion is the bigger version. Spreadsheets are a form of story and narrative. Everything could be a form of story and narrative for how you use it. It all comes down to, when I say it's simple, it is simple. It's just who, what, where, when, why.
And the element of time.
Yeah, when.
So it like began – that the story began.
There's a chronology.
Yeah, there's a
there's
chronology.
There's conflict. There's change. There's climax. That's it. There's characters. Something happens. They bump into things. Uh-oh, they change. A good story isn't Dave got up. He had an average day. He went to bed. The end.
Yeah.
There's no change. There's no conflict. There's no climax. Like, yeah. There's no why.
Right.
So I say we get back to what prompted us, the topic.
Okay.
Quiet quitting?
Yeah, so we were talking about this story that's everywhere in national media with the term quiet quitting, which basically, as I understand it, means people stay at their job and they just stop working and they keep taking a paycheck.
Well, that or they work to the rule, the compliance mentality, that's not my job mentality. They do the bare minimum, mediocre and just look to get out of work. So to me, it's nothing that new, right. But it's got this term.
It's got a term.
Right.
It's absolutely not new. Like when now that we're talking about it, I didn't bring this up, but that's the whole premise of the movie Office Space.
Yeah, of course.
You know, which is more than a decade old. How old is that movie now? Probably 20 years old.
I think it was 99.
Good God, it's more than 20 years old. You know, so this has been around for decades.
Well, no, it's been around for centuries.
Yeah, but I mean, it's been a part.
But not this term, though.
Oh, babe. No.
Not quiet
not
quitting.
Quiet
quitting. This is different.
This is the problem. People are lazy now, today.
Yeah, quiet quitting wasn't when the Industrial Revolution was going on and management was trying to better understand how all the machines work in the factories, that the people that actually fixed the machines chose not to give all of that information. No, that wasn't quiet quitting.
No,
that's
no.
Very different.
Well, back then, people were very industrious and worked hard. And since then, we've become lazy and entitled, right? I feel like that's the
narrative,
the message that we're supposed to be getting.
And so that's what you said. And so my question is, and not in a I disagree with you. I'm curious what you think.
Hi, I'm Mark Miller, owner of Miller Furniture, your home for quality American-made furniture since 1927. I'd like to expand on Life Lab's motto, which is experiment with life, and how it relates to us as a furniture company. We're currently in our 95th year in our American furniture retail experiment. Each year, we continue to tweak and optimize what we can do for you, our valued customer. And in any experiment, you must have control groups and variables. Our control groups are, first, you must be incredibly knowledgeable about your product. And this allows you to help customers make really good home furnishing choices that they'll love for many, many years. Secondly, you must provide accurate delivery expectations when the customer is in the research and purchasing phase. And third, you must address any and all customer issues after the sale. So that's the controls. If you can't do that, you're never going to be any good at furniture retail. We've been doing this 95 years, and that is a constant, those three things. Now the fun part, the variables, things that change all the time. And I think, how can I optimize my showroom and my website so that customers love it more each and every year? Well, first, we look at different vendors. So as an independent furniture store, we have over 100 different vendors. I find new ones every single year when I go to some of the exclusive furniture markets around the country. The other important thing is, these vendors, are they equipped to provide what my customers need? So do my customers want more design options, or do they want faster delivery? Because it's often a weighing of that. If a vendor offers 100 different styles, how can you possibly be producing them quick enough? You know, maybe you only want to offer 10 styles and get them to the customer in 6 weeks instead of 6 months, those kinds of decisions. Product styles, those will always vary and evolve. We know that styles are cyclical and things come back over time, and we center around classic designs with strong staying power, because when you buy a solid hickory top or solid cherry wood Amish-made table or bedroom set, most people expect that to last 20 or 30 years. So you don't want to go too trendy, but it is important to have more trendy design options so that you have some, like, right-now appeal.
Okay, so we always hear the mainstream media. Well, whoever that is, whether it's Fox or CNBC, MSNBC, I don't care which side of the spectrum it's on, those are owned by giant companies. Mm-hmm. Okay, so then when we hear quiet quitting, oh, they're just pushing that agenda. Well, how does that benefit the shareholders of the large company by pushing out an agenda?
I've got a theory.
Okay, yeah, I'm asking, like...
Yeah, so I mean, one of the measures of GDP is productivity, mm-hmm. and productivity just measures what we output for how many people are out in the workforce, mm-hmm. and productivity has gone down since the pandemic, and if you think about, and now I'll tie it to even a bigger story, right? So I can make shit up, which is what
that's what stories are.
That's what we do.
That's what
right?
stories are.
And then tell myself, this is why this is happening. Am I right? Probably not. I mean, if anything, brings me back to the story, Freakonomics, right? Like, I can weave a good story, and I might even be convincing to myself. If I can convince myself, then I think I probably can convince some other people. But how much of what I'm talking about is correlation versus causation, right? That's the whole book, Freakonomics, that delves into. So side note plug, great book. If you haven't read it, read it. I'll go ahead and try to make something up here that makes sense. I'll tell a story. So because productivity is a huge economic measure that gets used, it also drives certain things. It drives the business environment, the business landscape. And I'll tie it back to a couple things that I think are concerning to both big business and to government and power structures such as the financial industry, the Federal Reserve, things like that. So productivity has been going down. Obviously, everyone is concerned about that, especially with the fact that, quote unquote, our employment situation is very good. So employment statistics are very high. It's not like people are getting laid off or anything. So it's almost like there's a conflict there. If the employment situation is good, how come we aren't being more productive? And productivity drives GDP. GDP drives things like tax receipts, which our government can use to spend. On a side note, and I am going to connect things that probably aren't connected. Our government just hired 87,000 IRS agents because they're trying to increase tax revenue. The past quarter was the biggest fall in tax revenue, I think, on record, because the Fed is tightening.
I want to make sure for our listeners that you get tie this back to why the owners of CNN would want quiet quitting. Okay, I'm just making sure because that.
So my point is the entire power structure that influences big business and big corporations and works with them hand in hand has a vested interest in productivity, labor productivity. The world is changing, and I think that this is one of the stories that they're telling to try to influence everyone's behavior and in this situation try and make people more productive.
So they're using quiet – David Zaslav, the CEO of Warner Brothers Discovery, which is the media – global media conglomerate that owns CNN. He's talked with his board and he's talked with his executive leadership team, and they've given the green light to the narrative of quiet quitting. Let's pump that out through our channels as a way to stimulate GDP is what you're saying.
No, you –
No, I'm asking.
No. What I'm saying is Discovery Media runs stories that have a vested interest from their advertisers and huge industry leaders like Koch Industries and BlackRock run advertising through those media companies and influence the stories that get told, including quiet quitting.
So how does quiet quitting benefit Larry Fink, the CEO of BlackRock?
Like I was just describing, there's a hope that it influences productivity measures. Those productivity measures show up on balance sheets of large corporations because their employees are being more productive. It drives tax revenue, so it makes other big government.
If those stories about quiet quitting are bad, right? Because there's stories out there about quiet quitting being good, saying, hey, you're being exploited. That's what I was getting. Because you can go either way with quiet quitting. Some of the stories I've seen are, hey, you don't like what's happening. Here's the prescription for how you can quiet quit and what that means. I don't see how that benefits BlackRock. That's what I was talking about. You were thinking a different way. No. Yeah. The problematic articles
Everything I'm saying relies on – you have to accept the premise that these stories are meant to make us feel lazy.
Sure.
That narrative that I said at the beginning. We used to be productive and industrious. Our grandparents were right. They were hard workers. They worked from the time they woke up to the time they went to bed. And now we've become lazy and entitled and used to free shit from China or cheap shit from China. And we're worthless.
And foreigners fund our entire consumption-based economy.
Exactly. And we're so worthless that now we're not even working at work. And we're just taking money and feeling entitled. That's my
– gotcha.
Yeah. So if you don't what this is saying, then everything
Well, I'm just saying the quiet quitting piece, some of those articles saying this is a good thing. But maybe that article is the one that forces us to be talking about it.
And maybe there's competing forces at play.
Well, of course there are. Yeah, yeah.
So maybe there are some
That could be a clickbait story, and we've clicked it because we're talking about it, and I read it from Pomp's letter. I mean, it was nuts. It was a paragraph like, hey, here's how to quiet quit, and here's why you should do it.
Right.
That doesn't benefit any company.
And I'll just make this up, right? So you can have these rogue or competing forces, right? So I don't know. I'll just make shit up that makes sense to me. Labor organizations, right? Unions. They want to fight against this. They see what I said and they think that that's true, right? So then they are like, got to launch a counteroffensive and be like, well, we need some quiet quitting articles that paint it in a good light, mm-hmm. that it should be happening. And these are all the benefits of quiet quitting and why it should become.
Sure.
You get what I'm saying.
So, no, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, no, that's good.
Is any of this true?
Exactly. And, well, that's where being business owners, you have to take this shit with a grain of salt from what you read in the mainstream media. And that's why you really shouldn't follow it that much. Just get in your trenches, whatever, wherever your trench is, and do the work that needs to be done as a human being, whether that's your family side or, hey, I need to exchange my labor and knowledge for dollars side, or both. I see this stuff very real in the different businesses I'm involved with. You know, being a consultant for 70 different ongoing businesses, being an owner in a sports bar chain, which is a very real retail-driven, salt-of-the-earth kind of business, people are talking about these things. Like, so my point with narrative, story, whatever you want to call it, is there's reflexivity to it. So even if it's bullshit, even if we're never an objective observer outside of an idea. Ideas, story, and a story is just the best vehicle to package a good idea and infect it and spread it to people. And not infect in a bad way, a good way too. But it can change how people think and what people do.
And does.
It does do it.
Yeah.
And so I am seeing that on the ground floor across businesses I'm involved with.
Yeah.
And not in the good way.
Yeah. No, I've changed from when I was in high school till now. Remember, you and I both were on high school debate, right? And so I think about the way that those were done, right? We're trying to persuade people and we're literally debating. And it was just like, here's a fact, and here's another fact, and here's another fact, and these facts outweigh your facts. Who gave the best facts at the end of the thing? Terrible. Terrible, right? That was called policy debate. And right. Then there was another one called Lincoln-Douglas debate, mm-hmm. And that was more story-driven.
Yep.
And I liked Lincoln-Douglas debate way more. I did it, but it was seen as like the least serious one, the less serious one. You know, like if you were going to be on the debate team and you were going to be serious, you were going to be a policy debater. And I feel like that has changed in politics today. I don't know that this is true, but I suspect back then, so we're talking about the 90s, if you were to observe political sessions, there would be a lot of numbers, a lot of facts thrown around and stuff. Where now, it's all almost – I mean, it's not all. They still throw numbers and facts, but it's more narrative and emotional driven. Like our politicians are, you know, our country is quote unquote divided, right? And we just had the insurgency where they stormed the Capitol when Trump was president.
But I think that ties into where we're at with technology. We surround ourselves with devices that make narrative more potent.
Sure.
Politics is the game of emotions. Sure. It's the ultimate game of emotions. It's primal. That's why it's all about power, tapping into that. That's why political rallies, it can be such a silly thing, but it's not, because people want to tap into that primal nature, and that's what politics is about. And so with the screens and everything we surround ourselves with, where we can just pump these stories which touch our emotional nature, of course it heightens things.
Well, these are tools that can push out stories so that you're always telling or consuming a story.
But my point with fact, when you're talking about fact or numbers, all people are trying to do is equate science. They're trying to use and be on the coattails of science. Science is the dogged pursuit of truth. Hard stop, period. That's it. That's what science is.
It is.
But people try to latch on to that by using numbers and stats. Economists act like what they're doing is pure truth-seeking, borrowed from the natural scientists, but it's not, because the stories they tell about the facts they have are reflexive. They influence prices, stock prices, all that influences buying behavior. But all the classic theories, the classic narrative about it is the efficient market hypothesis, and that's all horseshit.
I agree with you 100%.
Yeah, I'm not saying we don't agree.
No, I think where I was going with that was, it seems to me like back then, a lot of the way that I argued and thought and the things that I heard more, sure, there were stories. There's always been stories. Like that's what drives people, you know? If you think about it, why do we love movies? Why do we read books? Why do we tell stories to each other that when we're at a party or whatever? Like, stories are the things that drive our emotions, our thoughts, our wants, our desires, our beliefs. Yes, they influence us. Absolutely. And yes, they are reflexive. I guess what I was trying to say was back then in policy debate, it would be like, here is a statement, and then here's a bunch of things to back up that statement.
Yeah, no, I'm not disagreeing. Yeah. I'm actually fully on board. Yeah. I do think there are things as facts or statements, and all that means is things that have occurred that can't be disproven. An easy one that I remember from college, 9/11 happened. Planes were flown into buildings. People died. That's we cannot dispute that without getting into metaphysical bullshit. Yeah, okay,
it did happen.
Now, as soon as we start putting intentionality in there, the why, the stories we start to spin, that is when it moves from fact to interpretation, from fact to. But policies can also be driven not by facts and statements, but by the stories we tell, which is what the whole Iraq war was.
Well, they are.
The story that was told. So for me, the master politicians are great storytellers, and they know – they look at the policies they're crafting as stories.
Yeah. Well, yeah. You know, the Shock Doctrine by Naomi Klein is a book that talks about this. But and there are many others that talk about exactly what you're talking about, which is – and here's this narrative. The government uses events – crisis events to take more control.
Well, that's just always been the case.
And once they have that control, you
they
never get it
back. They don't cede ground.
And if you go to the airport today – you will see that in play when they go through your bags and you have to take your shoes off and your belt off and walk, and it takes you an hour to get through security or more. But that's to keep us safe, Zach, right? So that's the why. Why? Because if they don't do that, then people are going to fly airplanes into our buildings again. Mm-hmm. That's the story. Right? That now it's commonly accepted.
But they have – now it's jobs. Hey, we've created jobs for these folks in TSA. Now it's people's livelihoods,
well,
that too.
That too.
Well, that's what they'll point to once the system is started and moving.
That's part of it. That's definitely part of it.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. You had a point.
No. Yours will be more important. I can bring mine up whenever.
Well, I was just going to talk about how – this relates to something called narrative psychology. So this is an actual field of study in psychology. And a guy named Walter Fisher is the one who
I'm very familiar with old Fisher.
He coined the term narrative psychology in the 60s, I guess. And he wrote books about it through the 80s. But one of the, like his ideas, I think, are – very interesting.
Yeah, he calls us homo narrans. We're the storytelling animal. That's what he says that's what differentiates us from every single animal. We tell the stories that cement our history, our present, and our future. That, for him, is what differentiates us.
I like that a lot. I mean, go back to one of our very first episodes, if not our very first, Happiness. We talked about how one of the things that makes humans different is our ability to have an imagination, right? And so we have a simulation machine in our head, and we can basically say what, you know, your point of what happens next, we run it through our simulation machine and
we come up with the best hypothesis for what'll grab people's attention.
Man. Well, it's funny how we use our simulation machine, right? Like we can imagine great things happening or we can imagine terrible things happening, and that's what we decide, oh, that's more likely or this is more likely because of this or that's what this group wants or that's what this other group wants. And then what can we do to influence that from either happening or not happening? It's amazing. It is phenomenal. Yep. One of the things that they said that narrative psychology says that I thought was really interesting is about how we all begin as actors, right? And so when I was talking about that, like, oh, that kind of makes sense. You know, when you're young, you feel like you're an actor, you're on a stage, everyone could be watching you. I remember oftentimes when I was young feeling like that, right? Like, what if the world's watching me right now? And it would influence the way that I acted.
All the world's a stage, Shakespeare.
Right. And that was before the world really was watching us.
Right.
Back in the 80s, there weren't cameras everywhere, and now there are. But I think that thought that was interesting. And then it said, once we're old enough to have goals, we become agents, where we're trying to influence those things and have those goals. And then eventually we all start to organize our experiences and insights into a narrative of ourselves. And then that's when we switch to authors. We become authors. Anyway,
I like that.
I like that.
The question I go to ties into this point, so I'm glad you made it, is who's the protagonist in your life story? Are you right? We all, of course, each person thinks of themselves that way. But think about that. Like, are you the protagonist or are you the friend? Do you let other people determine your paths and choices, or do you craft and cultivate them on your own? When are you the antagonist in your life story? Mm. And I think a lot of people, of course, view themselves as the protagonist, but act like the friend in their own life.
Meaning they allow others to make the
decisions. They live the life of others. Yeah. They live the life that others are choosing for them. Just literally think about it like a book. If your life is a story, that just means it's in different chapters. Okay, what chapter am I in? What do I need my character to be doing? What goal is this guy moving towards? What climax is he? Did he already hit it? If so, boy, that sucks. Then what's the rest of the point of life? Like, that's why I always want what's next, what's coming. I don't want to hit my climax now. I want to hit it when I'm 72, 82.
So as you were saying that, something popped in my head that I thought was a decent thought to mention, which is it has to be that way. If everyone was their protagonist, like, think about it. Let's go back and say we're in the hunter-gatherer phase, right? We've got bows and arrows, and there's certain things that need to be done for our little tribe, right? Mm-hmm. It's like, I want to be the hunter. I want to be the one with the bow shooting the animals, right? It's like, well, somebody needs to be the one cleaning the animal, and someone needs to be the one cooking it. Someone needs to be making our keeping our shelter, like, you know, like, yeah, but I don't want that. I want to be the bow guy. And like, well, I want to be the bow guy too. Well, I want to be the bow guy too. Like,
well, that's where,
fuck
again,
you guys, I'm doing the bow thing.
But then it's also know thyself. And when you were talking way back earlier in our conversation, you're like, oh, it's about the tribe and serving the tribe. Somebody's still determining what the tribe needs.
Yeah. Well, that's the interesting part of where leadership comes into play, which obviously you know this better than anybody, but keep going.
No, I just think it's so going with the tribe. Okay, I have five sons in the tribal society. The five sons, oh, they're the hunters. But what if the one son ain't the hunter? Then I'm going to feel status and some shame that my son can't do the hunting, even though he clearly, if he doesn't have that skill, maybe he likes to do the cooking. But that brings me shame because that's what the women do back then.
This is awesome.
And there's all kinds of different stories. Again, they wouldn't have called them that back then, but that's what's going on. It's status. It gets back to the primal stuff. Status.
Well,
ego.
You're bringing in – you're doing a good job of bringing in something that I was going to get to, and this will be probably the last real important idea that I'm ripping off from Fisher.
Now, Fisher's awesome. And Bob Krizek, man, he had us reading Fisher. That's the book I pulled out earlier.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Awesome. And so this is the idea that I thought was really good. It's that there's basically two theories to what drive people, right? Rational world paradigm or the narrative paradigm. Mm-hmm. And so I was going to go down the road with the tribe thing of, well, sure, everybody wants to be the bow hunter, but the important stuff needs to get done. So everyone can't be that. So somebody needs to cook and clean the animal. Someone needs to build the whatever. And that to me is rational, right? It's just rational. Like, I'm thinking through what has to get done. And so that would be the rational. But what you did was, I didn't even get to go there. And you were like, I've got five sons and I want them to be the hunters because that makes my family look good. And that's the narrative paradigm, right? Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting. As I was reading this, I was like, if you read the rational world paradigm, there are beliefs like people are essentially rational. People make decisions based on argument. The communicative situation determines the course of our argument. And rationality is determined by how much we know and how well we argue. And the world is a set of logical puzzles we can solve through rational analysis versus the narrative paradigm. People are essentially storytellers. People make decisions based on good reasons. History, biology, culture, and character determine what we consider good reasons. Narrative rationality is determined by coherence and fidelity of our stories, and that's an important one.
If you can't spin up a story around rationality, that's what makes humans so damn problematic. Is we're great bullshitters. We're great rationalizers. We can take any thing that it sounds irrational and we can wrap it, and we can find logic and wrap it in it. And to me, that's just the story piece. To me, the storytelling piece, Homo Narin, is more foundational for our species than the rationality piece. Now, maybe we wouldn't be around today if it wasn't also for the rationality piece. I'm not saying that that's not important, But the story we tell about it and how we use it, reason and rationality, to me, the story piece is more all-encompassing because we're a social species and stories are the vehicle from which we can get things done.
Yeah. I mean, I'm going – as I get older, I go more toward that, which is funny.
Like, what's the story of yourself? What story do you you're dying tomorrow. You got to tell your story to your kids, the story of Dave Ponder. What story do you tell?
Yeah, that's a good one.
Well, yeah, and I'm not saying tell
well,
me.
No,
I'm
and like, I think we're work. I think we do a good job of trying to inspect that story through things that we do, like journaling every day,
right? Right.
Having these podcasts.
Yeah, there's things
to be,
we do, but I also think telling the story as it's unfolding, narrating the story as it's unfolding, is very different than going back and writing your autobiography or telling the story retrospectively. Because, oh boy, you can just connect all kinds of things that weren't fucking connected at all and make it look like, oh, I had a grand plan the whole time. All my mistakes were really strategic to help get me to where I am today. That's what they all do.
Yeah, but I feel like people also tell themselves stuff that holds them back. Like,
well, the self-limiting beliefs. Yeah,
yeah. I mean, so people justify certain behaviors. Well, I guess it's still a justification of a behavior, but it's almost justification of a limitation, like a mm-hmm. learned limitation. So you can try to blunt the pain with your story in some ways, and you can, for some reason, I guess it's like living out of fear, right? Like, so you give yourself a reason why you won't do certain things or can't do certain things. Just to justify your fears.
Yeah, you sell yourself. I always tell folks, you sell yourself on a story first before you sell it to anyone else. When you're coming up with an excuse or a reason you didn't hold a commitment that you made to others, you don't go start selling other people on anything till you convince yourself, yeah, that this works. No, and you honestly believe it. No, this excuse does make sense.
Yeah, perfect. Which is exactly what I did with that whole quiet quitting thing, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I just made all that up in my head. Makes sense to me.
Yep.
If I can convince myself, then I think
I can convince other people. Exactly.
Yeah.
Nice. Okay. Well, yeah, I think we've hit on all the things I wanted to talk about. For me, it was like strategy at the narrative level, tactical at the story level. I like everything you've brought up. What else do you have?
No, that's really it.
I think we've hit it.
Yeah.
We're concise today.
The last thing that I will throw out there is the idea of meta-truths. So these are truths that we accept that are embedded in stories that we tell over and over again. So the good one is, if I lie, people won't trust me. This is just an example. This is not the good one. There are many good ones. But the boy who cried wolf is mm-hmm. a story that gets told over and over again in many different forms. And there are just these certain meta-truths that we've accepted as a species, and that we embed in our stories as lessons to try and keep that idea embedded in those around us so that it influences the way that we behave.
Well, and I think a lot of those meta-truths for us tie back to being social animals. If I don't tell the truth, I can't get along with the rest of the tribe, the group. And I think a lot of those tie back to that, and living isolated isn't useful to people.
Well, it's like those are shortcuts.
Heuristics.
Yeah. It's a way to embed a lesson and influence behavior
right.
in a very efficient,
quick
manner.
Way that, yeah. that anybody can grasp. To me, from when I took a narrative analysis class, and we differentiated between big T truths and small T truths. And stories can be useful wrappers for either one. But I do. Some people don't believe in any big T truths. They think everything's purely relative. But that's the narrative and story they're telling themselves. Again, it's all, what's the story here?
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Nice. Well, no, I just think it's powerful. If I'm thinking about everything we're talking about, I think it's powerful to recognize that everything is a story. You know, everything that you hear, tell, believe, read, they're
when,
all
when you're down
stories.
And depressed, yeah. you're going to talk to somebody, whether it's a professional or a peer. Hopefully you're not holding it in, or you're getting on TikTok nowadays and talking to those mental health influencers. You're looking for a new story. Your story's broke down.
Yeah.
You're not the protagonist anymore. You need a helping hand to pick you up.
Yeah. 100%.
And nice.
And all the stories are stories wrapped in a story. I like that thing that you said.
The molten metal.
The last thing that I thought, let me throw out there, is medium, right? A picture's worth 1,000 words. So you just talked about TikTok, right? That's a tiny video. Videos are even better than single pictures.
Oh, 100%.
And all it is trying to tell a story. It's just
video trumps picture. Picture trumps word. Brevity trumps longevity with messaging.
Yeah. I like it.
And it's all about getting that the core of the story to stick in someone's brain. It's not even about that. It's actually about the spread. It's all about can you retell that story to somebody else
and
to gain influence.
Here's another one that I love. Shared experiences generate stories, and it's interesting to hear if the people who share the experience don't talk to each other, the different stories that they tell versus when they get together and agree upon that shared experience.
Here's
how the story evolves.
Yeah. When I'm doing decision making with the leadership team at the Post, or the sports bar I'm involved with, I am always thinking, trying to think from the guest perspective and think, okay, we're trying to make a decision on whether we should put a capital investment into something, let's say, or whether we should partner with a vendor. I'm always asking myself, what story could the guest share with somebody else to bring somebody through the door? That's always what I'm going to. Like, whatever it is, like, I want them to be able to tell a story, a quick one, to bring a new person through the doors. Walter Fisher would be proud.
Walter Fisher would be proud. All right. So you
nice. I got a change challenge. Right. Change challenge. Think of a recent experience, a brief experience that you had that you weren't happy with, the outcome of the experience. Whatever. It doesn't have to be some, like, long thing that unfolded over years. It could be a quick – if you went to Six Flags and something negative happened. Put it in story form, just in your head. You don't have to write it down. But think about it like you're watching it like a movie or reading it like a book, and you're the main character. Where were the choice points that your main character had that you missed at the time as it was unfolding? What could you, looking back, what could you have done differently to make the story end better? I really when I think back and reflect on things, I'm always going, okay, Zach's the main character. Like, oops, he totally missed this offering, this olive branch from somebody. He was too self-absorbed or whatever was going on. So where were the opportunities you had to notice something different, observe something different, think about something different, or take a different action that would have changed how the story unfolded?
That's so good. That's something that I know that I need to personally work on. Conscientiousness.
Mm.
Yeah. So good. I don't have a change challenge.
Okay.
Let's stick with that one.
Okay.
That was great.
Perfect. Well, we were very concise today, about 40 minutes. We've talked about stories and narratives being multi-layered meta stories, different, how they can drive action, how they're reflexive, how there are actual facts and statements, but then we can bend those to our will to try to influence others. We talked about trying to think of yourself as the main character in your story. And yeah, I mean, where are you at in your life story right now? What chapter are you in? What is your character doing that you want him or her to be doing? And what is he or she not doing? How could you help them start doing it? So get out there and remember that life is a lab and a story, and experiment with life.